The aftershocks of the coup are still being felt today. The coup came 2 years after Mossadegh nationalized Iran's oil industry. He argued Iran should begin profiting from its vast oil reserves, which had been exclusively controlled by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. The company later became known as British Petroleum, BP. The coup was led in part by a CIA agent named Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt. The crushing of Iran's first democratic government ushered in more than two decades of dictatorship under the Shah, who relied heavily on U.S. aid and arms. The anti-American backlash that toppled the Shah in 1979 shook the whole region. In a moment, we'll be joined by two guests who've researched the coup for years. But first, we turn to the trailer of the documentary Coup 53.
In 1953, the United States, together with Britain, participated in a coup in Iran that got rid of Mossadegh.
Mossadegh and his government were swept from power in favor of General Zahedi. 300 killed and hundreds wounded is a conservative estimate.
The British government has never officially acknowledged its role in the coup.
I don't think at any time we really planned a coup d'etat.
These words have not been heard or seen for over 34 years.
Evidence that has the potential to turn a dark chapter in history inside out.
Your British counterpart was, in fact, blank. Could you tell me something about the man, blank?
Norman Derbyshire, take one.
He was somebody who felt that there were things to be said that hadn't been said.
A member of the British government was involved in the assassination of the chief of police.
How did it come to this?
So they tied him up, strangled him, and shot him. Were you involved in Afshar II's assassination?
Yes.
My father is a real prime minister.
The coup in Iran is shaping politics to this day. The United States does not want democracy in the Middle East.
That's the trailer of the documentary Coup 53, directed by the Iranian filmmaker Taghi Amirani, who's joining us now. He made the film with the Oscar-winning filmmaker Walter Murch. We're also joined by Yervan Abrahamian. He's a retired professor of history at City University of New York, Baruch College. His most recent book is titled Oil Crisis in Iran, From Nationalism to Coup d'Etat, the author of several books, including The Coup, 1953, The CIA, and The Roots of Modern U.S.-Iran Relations. We are talking about an event 70 years ago that has shaped not only the Middle East, but I think you could say geopolitics in the world today. Yervan Abrahamian, if you can start off by talking about the significance of this moment. I mean, a year after the same model would be used to overthrow the democratically elected leader in Guatemala. But what happened? Why the United States and Britain were so hell-bent on toppling democracy in Iran?
Well, the official argument that is constantly repeated was it was to save Iran from communism and the Soviet threat. In reality, when you look at the documents, there was no communist threat or Soviet interest in Iran. The main concern of United States was that if nationalization in Iran of oil was successful, this would set a terrible example to other countries where U.S. oil interests were present, countries such as Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Indonesia. So the nightmare in Washington was that if you have a successful nationalization in Iran, this would be a contagious disease that would spread throughout the world, and this would change the whole balance of power. And this was really the main interest. But of course, American politicians don't want to admit that economic issues are at play with their foreign policy. So they underplayed this. They never mentioned this publicly. What they insisted was the so-called communist threat. The British, in fact, were quite honest about this. They said they used the bogey of communism to basically persuade people that the coup was justifiable.
But Professor, when you say there was no communist threat to take over the country, but there certainly was a vibrant communist party in Iran at the time, the Tuda Party, which backed nationalization, even though it also opposed Mossadegh on a bunch of issues. Wasn't the attempt of the United States to use, and actually, as I understand it, some of the documents revealed recently show that the British and the U.S. actually tried to stir up the population in Iran against the communists by actually backing false flag operations in the weeks before the overthrow?
They did that, but, you know, the Tudeh Party was, you can say, had its strength in the factories, in the street. They organized strikes, demonstrations. But people in Washington, people like Roosevelt, the Dulleses, Eisenhower, were hard-nosed realists. They knew that there's a difference between, you know, organizing a demonstration in Tehran to carrying out a revolution or a coup. And the CIA reports from Tehran, these are the actual CIA and analysts on the ground, they said that the Tudeh Party was not a threat. It wasn't even prepared for a coup. It wasn't talking and thinking of a coup. And it even the readings that was required for Tudeh Party members in 1953 was Lenin's work on ultra-leftism, infantile leftism. So a Communist Party that was thinking about a coup or a revolution would not be using Lenin's infantile leftism as a main instruction book. So this was an imagined threat. And they, of course, the press, especially the New York Times, played up with this. They exaggerated the two-day strength, the size of their demonstrations, in order to create the mood in the American public that there was actually a major threat coming from the left in Iran.
Turn to an excerpt from Coup 53, where we see our other guest, the filmmaker Taghi Amirani, as he meets with Malcolm Byrne at the National Security Archive.
I am the deputy director and research director at the National Security Archive, which is a non-governmental organization based at George Washington University. There are at least three internal histories that the CIA has produced. In probably the late 1970s, one of these items was produced.
Is this when you write to them asking for information?
Well, this is the response letter to me saying we're enclosing this document that you requested, and then Here's the document itself called The Battle for Iran.
The Battle for Iran, which is still going on.
This is what's new about this release, covert action. In earlier versions, which you'll see, this is all blotted out. Keep that out.
So we can take this one out.
There's still a lot that's not there.
I like the fact that there's still lots of blank pages.
They're supposed to show you what was there.
Right.
What was new was essentially this page. Uh-huh. The military coup that overthrew Mossadegh and his National Front cabinet was carried out under CIA direction. They had never, to my knowledge, officially acknowledged their role.
Right.
In the coup.
I'm standing in front of a filing cabinet of a drawer full of documents that essentially changed the fate of my country and changed my fate. Mm-hmm. You know, what happened to me? What happened to my family? My it's just like how your lives, your destiny, your fate is encapsulated.
Yeah, in a half a file drawer.
In a half, this is it. This just changed Iran. This box of papers. Mm.
In this next clip from Coup 53, Taghi Amirani reads from the interview transcripts he found with the MI6 spy Norman Derbyshire that were done for the British TV series End of Empire.
Excellent. If we want the coup in detail, and even if not.
Why did they select bits of interview from him, cut it out, paste it into a script, probably edit it into the film, but he didn't make the final cut? He's not in the finished film.
In a remarkable stroke of luck, we've discovered that the British Film Institute archive hold all the unused footage from the End of Empire Iran episode. Freely available to the public, but never digitized until now. 36 cans of film, 520 minutes of interview, among which we hope to find Norman Derbyshire.
And it's recording. Great.
Digitized the entire collection of End of Empire given to us by the BFI. We did not find Norman Derbyshire.
And in this clip from Coup 53, Taghi Amirani goes through the photographs and film clips he accessed from End of Empire, the British TV series about the end of the British Empire, as he searched for footage of the MI6 spy, Norman Derbyshire.
British Embassy staff photograph, Tehran, class of 1952. And this is Norman Derbyshire, looking very much the cool undercover spy. Derbyshire would have been 29 when this photograph was taken. He was born on the 1st of October 1924, and he died on the 17th of June 1993. His CIA counterpart was Stephen Mead. We found his can of film, even though he's not in the finished film. Stephen Mead on Iran. This is what End of Empire production team thought of Stephen Mead. A young 69, hatchet-faced, like a bit part player in a B-movie thriller, and above all, good. This is brilliant. Wow. Your British counterpart was, in fact, blank. Could you tell me something about the man, blank?
Your British counterpart was, in fact, Norman Derbyshire. Could you tell us something about the man, Norman Derbyshire?
Oh, I didn't know him at all before I met him.
What kind of a man was blank?
What kind of a man was Norman Derbyshire?
What kind of a man was Norman Derbyshire? And why has his name been blanked out in these documents?
And in this clip from Coup 53, the actor Ray Fiennes reenacts the part of the Norman Derbyshire interview transcript found after he was interviewed, but did not appear in the End of Empire series.
Norman Derbyshire, take one. What you're about to see here as the team sets up at the Savoy is the result of our failure to find any film or audio of the Derbyshire interview. So we've resorted to bringing his words to life.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
Ray Fiennes is about to speak Derbyshire's words recorded back in 1983, telling us things the British didn't want anyone to hear.
And these are the bits that the people who made the original documentary loved, which is also what we love.
Sorry, I'm getting drawn into the...
Mm-hmm. Just imagine how I felt when I came across it. It was one late night in the office.
Again, a clip from Coup 53. Taghi Amirani was an Iranian physicist who became a filmmaker and directed this documentary, Coup 53, released August 19th, 2019, the anniversary of the U.S.-backed, MI6-backed, or I should say created coup that overthrew the democratically elected leader of Iran. This is an astounding documentary. This is a documentary, Taghi, the likes of which we rarely see. If people are wondering why Ray Fiennes is in it, the famous actor, it's because he was replacing the cutout words of this British spy. If you can talk about what Derbyshire means in terms of British history in Iran, and also on the U.S. side, Kermit Roosevelt, who will later talk quite honestly about how he went on behalf of the Dulles brothers, right? John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA and the State Department. John Foster Dulles, who had represented corporations interested in overthrowing democracies. And overthrew Mossadegh.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to join you, and I'm delighted that you find the film astounding. And if it's astounding, it's entirely due to Walter Murch and the incredible cast of interviewees, including Professor Abrahamian, along with Stephen Kinzer and David Talbot and Malcolm Byrne, who were the backbone of commentary and knowledgeable information on the coup. In the absence of the British official admission to their leading role in this coup, Norman Derbyshire's interview and its transcript stands in for that admission. Imagine you making a film about the most important pivotal event in your country's history, which didn't just affect Iran, but the region and the world, as we've discussed, and we will discuss more. And you find the man who was essentially the writer and director of this coup, in his own words, revealing the most incredible amount of detail, going rogue for whatever reason. We can speculate as to why he went rogue as the leading MI6 officer in charge of the coup, giving this incredible interview and then vanishing. And for whatever reason, the End of Empire producers, Brian Lapping, Norma Percy, Mark Anderson and Alison Roper could not or did not use this interview in any form in their film. We got lucky. I got lucky. I am not the world's best documentary maker, but I am the luckiest in the team I got together, the interviewees I managed to persuade to appear, and just a lucky break to come across this transcript, which was, ironically, in the basement of Mossadegh's grandson in Paris, until I showed up and found it by chance. And my mind just blew by the level of revelation and staggering amount of detail.
Tug Amirani, I wanted to ask you the lessons for today, especially for people in other parts of the world about these coups, is the way that the British government and the U.S. government often try to mask their actions by promoting so-called demonstrations or uprisings in the street against governments that they wanted overthrown. Particularly, I think, in the Iranian situation, the use of radical Islamic clerics. For instance, there was at the time Ayatollah Khashoggi, who had been a collaborator with the Nazis during World War II, but then was utilized by the British and the Americans to stir up protests against the Mossadegh regime. And of course, there was a young cleric, Khomeini, a follower of Khashoggi, who was in the street protesting against Mossadegh at the time. Could you talk about how the use by the United States and the British, because of course they went on to do it in Afghanistan against Sadat in Egypt and others, to use radical Islamic clerics as a means to attack modernists or progressive political leaders?
My enemy's enemy is always my friend. And in fact, Ayatollah Khashoggi was very much on Mossadegh's side. They were working together in trying to nationalize oil and stand up to the British. They parted ways in July 1952 in a huge demonstration when Mossadegh resigned because he wanted to have more control in the executive power and wanted the Shah to be just a simple symbolic monarch. But they parted ways because in Khashoggi's eyes, Mossadegh was becoming a hungry dictator and trying to keep too much control in his hands. The melting pot of the currents against Mossadegh was multifaceted. The mob was created. The religious community turned against him. Of course, agents were underground. Bribery was obviously a key point. The press were bought. These are the key ingredients of any coup. And once you've got those key elements in place, including assassination of key allies, it's a repeat and rinse process. I don't have information of Ayatollah Khomeini, a young Khomeini, being in the crowd, but I know in Oliver Stone's series, The Secret History of the United States, or The Untold History of the United States, it is mentioned. But there is a lot of debate about the conflict between Khashoggi and Mossadegh. He certainly expressed delight at the fall of Mossadegh post-coup, and he had ambitions about being the leader of the Muslim world, not just in Iran. But Mossadegh had he'd written his own death sentence the moment he nationalized oil. The British decided he had to go that moment. In fact, we have people in our interviews from End of Empire saying the moment he came into office, we knew we had to get rid of him. The bogeyman of communism was exactly that. We have documents which we will put out in our new sequel. We are making a coda about what happened to Coup 53 since its release, called Coup 53.1. And in that, we will show these documents where the Americans are discussing with the British whether they'll come in and join the coup. And they're discussing share of the oil, basically saying, yeah, we'll help you if you can have a slice of, you know, Iranian oil, which is exactly what happened post-coup in the consortium that was formed, in which the American oil companies walked away with 40%. And so, yeah, it's still debated. It's still a hot topic. Of course, the impact's still with us. We're living with the consequences of the coup. And it, of course, it emboldened the CIA to go out and do it again in Guatemala. In fact, this year we are marking the 50th anniversary of the Chilean coup. Pinochet replacing Allende, like the Shah replaced Mossadegh. History is not the past. The past is not the past. And we're still living with the ripples of this disastrous event.
Taghi Amirani, if you can talk about specifically the U.S. role. You have this fascinating interview. What is it? The interview with Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, who is an official within the CIA, says he takes a couple suitcases filled with money, $1 million, but actually it only cost him $60,000. But talk about what he did in Iran, and doing this at the behest of the British. It was Anglo-Iranian oil, now BP. Iran had thrown out the British, seeing Mossadegh realize that the British were fomenting a coup. So they called on the U.S., and ultimately it would be under Eisenhower that they would overthrow Iran.
Yeah. See, I grew up, we all grew up with the story of the CIA coup run by Kermit Roosevelt. As Professor Abrahamian puts it very eloquently in our film, Kermit didn't speak Persian. He was only in Iran for 3 weeks. He didn't know Iran at all. He was more of a bagman and an adventurist. And he was allowed to go and take credit for the coup. He wrote books about it. He was on chat shows, talk shows. He had contracts. He had audiences with the Shah. He did really well out of this coup. And Derbyshire, as Ray Fiennes tells us in a brilliant interview in The New Yorker, essentially wanted his curtain call. He wanted to reclaim credit for what was his show. In fact, just last week, there was a huge profile of Derbyshire in The Guardian by Julian Borger, the foreign affairs editor of The Guardian, went in great detail about his life and his motives. And so this is essentially partly professional rivalry. I do all the hard work. Derbyshire was in Iran from the age of 19 as a soldier. He spoke probably better Persian than me. He knew the Iranian street. He really understood the psyche of the Iranian mob, as he says in the interview in our film. He knows how to turn them, what buttons to press. This was a Derbyshire project. And as we talked about earlier, the British wanted their oil back. This coup was always about oil. It's always about oil. Iraq was about oil. Venezuela is about oil. It's always about oil. As the great Robert Fisk said, if Iraq's only export was turnips, we wouldn't be there. And so Derbyshire is the main star of this film. For whatever reason, he didn't appear. We got lucky. We found him. We got lucky. We got Ray Fiennes to be his avatar. Everything that happened to Coup 53, the incentive for me making this film is the British have not officially admitted to their key role, their leading role. This was an MI6 coup aided by the CIA, who was dragged in. It was a new organization in 1953. It was the first time it went off campus to play, and it did well. You know, it was quick, it was cheap, and no Americans were killed. A few hundred Iranians died, but who cares about that? So it emboldened them to do it again. And it was, you know, there's a letter from Alan Dulles to Kermit after he comes back from Iran saying, have a great weekend. Come in on Monday. I've got some other ideas. Obviously, Guatemala coming up. There was one other thing I had to say. Kermit Roosevelt, in not really being an expert, given the playing field to write his book and give that interview to the clip that we see in the film where he says, I had a million, I'd spend 60,000. He gives another interview and says, he says, I had 700,000, I only spent 10,000. I wouldn't take anything Kermit Roosevelt says at face value as the truth. He was a fabricator of stuff and a self-aggrandizing guy. And that, I can see, will also not sit well with Derbyshire. You know, Kermit just spewing out different stories about how much money he spent. Derbyshire says in his interview, we you know, the coup cost £700,000. I know because I spent it.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Professor Abrahamian into the conversation again. Professor, this whole issue of the change in administrations in the United States, because the nationalization happened during the Truman administration, but President Truman was reluctant to intervene. According to some accounts, it was only when Eisenhower came in and, of course, the Dulles brothers, as part of his administration, that the coup went moved forward as far as the United States was concerned. Could you talk about the change in administrations and also the impact on Iran subsequent to the coup, of course, leading up to eventually the Iranian Revolution of 1979?
Yes, I mean, the conventional view is, as you said, it's that the Truman the Democratic administration was willing to negotiate and deal with Mossadegh. It was the Republican Eisenhower administration that carried out the coup. The trouble is, if you look at the documents, right from the beginning, as soon as Mossadegh was elected prime minister and nationalized, the Americans, at that time, the Truman administration was just as eager to actually get rid of Mossadegh. It was not they weren't thinking about a coup. They were thinking of a political means of getting rid of him. In fact, they asked the Shah to dismiss him. They misunderstood the Iranian constitution. The Shah didn't have the power to dismiss him. So right from beginning, the Truman administration was really trying to ease the Mossadegh out. But the interesting thing is, the reason for that was not because they were against coups. It was much more, surprisingly, the Shah's reluctance to carry out a coup. The Shah, right in 51, said that if I go against Mossadegh and oil nationalization, I will delegitimize my monarchy, the whole of my authority. I cannot do that. And he was the one who was very reluctant to carry out the coup. And
we have 30 seconds, Professor.
Right. What the Truman administration really wanted to do was get rid of Mossadegh through the political process. It was only when that failed that the new administration then actually put into effect a military coup.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Yervan Abrahamian, retired professor of history at the City University of New York, most recent book, Oil Crisis in Iran, From Nationalism to Coup d'Etat. And Taghi Amirani, the Iranian filmmaker, director of Coup 53. Everyone should see it. This is the 70th anniversary of the coup in Iran. A very happy birthday to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.